Hello and welcome back to the Electronic Intifada's live stream for Thursday, October 30th. Thank you for tuning in. I'm Nora Barrows-Friedman with my colleagues Ali Abunima, John Elmer, Asa Wynn-Stanley, and Tamara Nassar. It's day 755 of Israel's genocide in Gaza. Coming up, we'll talk to our contributor, Iman Alhaj Ali, author of The Mirror of Memory, to recount some of her experiences during the genocide. Later on in the program, John will cover the latest ceasefire positions and the exchange of captives in Gaza, along with a report of newly revealed footage of Hamas leader Yahya Sinwar moving around the front lines and meeting with commanders during the battle in Rafah in the final days of his life. But first, let's take a look at the news. Here's a brief summary of some of the latest developments this week in Palestine. In Gaza, Israel continued to break the ceasefire by killing and injuring Palestinians in airstrikes and drone attacks, and by sustaining the brutal siege on humanitarian aid and necessary equipment to feed people, rebuild infrastructure, and save lives. On October 28th, Israel claimed that Palestinian resistance forces killed an Israeli soldier in Rafah, and alleged that the body of an Israeli captive transferred from Gaza by Hamas did not match one of the 13 to be handed over as part of the ceasefire. The Israeli government stated that it would resume wide-scale attacks, and that night, Israeli airstrikes killed at least 104 Palestinians, including 46 children, and injured more than 250. Journalist Mohammed Al-Jabari filmed Palestinians carrying the bodies of their loved ones, including many children wrapped in small white shrouds, to cemeteries on Wednesday morning. Hamas rejected Israel's claims, saying its armed wing had no connection to any attack on Israeli soldiers in Rafah, and called on the international mediators to take immediate action to rein Israel in. The political party called Israel's airstrikes, quote, an extension of a series of violations committed over the past few days, including attacks that resulted in deaths and injuries, and the continued closure of the Rafah crossing, which confirms the insistence on violating the terms of the agreement and attempting to sabotage it. Since the ceasefire took hold on October 10th, at least 211 Palestinians have been killed and more than 500 injured, according to Gaza's health ministry. The Gaza government media office tallied at least 125 violations by Israel of the ceasefire before Tuesday's attacks. Included in that number were at least 52 shooting operations directly targeting civilians, 9 incursions of its vehicles into residential neighborhoods, crossing the so-called yellow line, in addition to 55 shelling and targeting operations and 11 bombings of civilian buildings. 21 citizens were arrested in various areas of the Gaza Strip as well, the media office stated. On Monday, an Israeli drone strike near Khan Yunis in the south killed at least 2 Palestinians. In the aftermath of Tuesday's airstrikes, Gaza's civil defense spokesperson Mahmoud Bassal said that rescue workers were still trying to recover the dead and wounded from underneath massive amounts of rubble. Hospitals were overwhelmed with injured people, he said. Reporter Ahmed Kahil captured this clip of a rescue operation on Tuesday night. Bassal said, quote, what is happening in Gaza today is a disgrace to humanity and highlights the international community's complicity through its silence in these violations. The continuation of these crimes amidst the world's silence is an unforgivable moral and humanitarian failure, Mahmoud Bassal said. Al Jazeera's Hani Mahmoud stated on Wednesday that emergency medical staff at Al-Shifa Hospital in Gaza City were reporting that their patients were coming in with severe shrapnel injuries from the Israeli missile strikes. Quote, the bombs and drone missiles fired by the Israeli military are packed with shrapnel, nails, and pieces of metal. And when they explode, that flies at very high speed and pierces through bodies. Many patients are bleeding internally. That's increasing the pressure on medical staff. And the fear did not end. There are still drones here in the skies of Gaza City. The kamikaze drones are hovering at a very dangerous low level, causing panic and fear, Hani Mahmoud said. On Wednesday, October 29th, two Palestinians were killed in the northern city of Beit Lahia after Israel claimed it targeted a weapons storage facility in direct continuation of attacks, even after it announced it was back to abiding by the ceasefire following the massacres on Tuesday. EuroMed Human Rights Monitor stated that, quote, Israel's genocide in Gaza has not ended. It has merely shifted into a quieter, less visible phase. By maintaining the siege and allowing intermittent attacks that kill civilians, Israel sustains a gradual process of extermination, while the world falsely claims the genocide has stopped. More Palestinian bodies were returned to Gaza this week by the Israeli military, many showing indications of torture and field executions, and many were returned unidentified. 41 bodies were buried with dignity in southern Gaza on Monday. Journalist Tamer Keshta captured this clip of civil defense workers preparing the bodies for burial. The health ministry in Gaza announced that it was opening up a new civil office to work on identifying the remains of hundreds of Palestinians who have been returned to Gaza by Israel without any identifying information. The ministry also launched an online portal to help families identify their missing relatives. On Wednesday, approximately 100 bodies of Palestinians belonging to the Al-Shahabar family, who were massacred in November 2023 in the Sabra neighborhood of Gaza City, were finally recovered and buried by their surviving relatives and community nearly 2 full years after they were slaughtered. Reporter Syed Hezbollah filmed the preparations in this clip. EuroMed Human Rights Monitor had carried out initial documentation of the series of massacres. According to their research, the attacks, quote, which took place over 2 days, November 17th and 18th, 2023, saw the use of aircraft and drones to target residential buildings, civilians inside their homes, and those attempting to bury relatives killed in earlier attacks. As civil defense crews try to recover thousands of Palestinians still missing and buried under the rubble caused by 2 years of Israel's ongoing assault, Israel maintains a total blockade on heavy machinery and recovery equipment. But it did allow in several heavy vehicles from Egypt in order to only locate and retrieve the bodies of the remaining Israeli captives. Reporter Issa Siam captured Egyptian heavy machinery operating in central Gaza on Monday. Drop Site News' Jeremy Scahill talked about the double standards in the context of whose bodies are deemed more important to recover on Democracy Now! Earlier this week.
There are believed to be roughly 13 or so bodies of Israeli captives left. The great Yemeni cartoonist Kamal Sharaf had a piece of art the other day that showed a camera snaked to a piece of construction equipment pummeling through the ground past dead Palestinian bodies to try to find one Israeli body. And, you know, everything that Israel has accused the Palestinians of, Israel does as a matter of doctrine. You know, the confession, the accusation is the confession, and we've seen that for 2 years. Donald Trump said, what kind of sick people hold dead bodies? Israel, since 1967, has had a policy of holding the bodies of Palestinians. As of before the genocide, there were believed to be more than 720 Palestinian bodies being held in coolers and numbered graves by Israel. There may be as many as 1,500 Palestinian bodies held by Israel since October 7th. So estimates are more than 2,000 dead Palestinian bodies are being held by Israel right now. One Palestinian political prisoner, his body has been held since 1980.
Jeremy Scahill on Democracy Now! Earlier this week. Turning to the occupied West Bank, we continue our reporting on the escalating attacks by Jewish Israeli settlers and soldiers on Palestinians. My colleague Tamara Nassar reports that in the first 2 weeks of the olive harvest season, which began in October, the UN monitoring group OCHA documented more than 85 harvest-related settler attacks on Palestinians and their property across 50 towns and villages in the occupied West Bank. The following is from Tamara's article, Olive Harvest Season Marked with Assault by Jewish Settlers, published on Wednesday. More than 110 Palestinians have been injured, 50 of them by Jewish settlers and the rest by the military. Settler attacks during the harvest season have ranged from violent assaults on farmers, theft of olives and harvesting equipment, and cutting down or uprooting trees, to obstructing access to land, among other violent attacks, including burning cars belonging to Palestinian residents. In many incidents, Israeli soldiers accompany the extremist settlers, either standing idly by or actively assisting the attacking settlers, said Yesh Din, an Israeli group that monitors settler activity in the West Bank. Both settlers and soldiers, quote, have so far enjoyed complete impunity for attacks against Palestinians, even deadly ones, the United Nations Human Rights Office said on Monday. In the first week of October, settlers had already cut down some 300 trees, according to Yesh Din. The group said no arrests were made and shared pictures from the Palestinian villages of Kafr Kadum in the north and Sa'ir in the south. The number has grown at least tenfold since, with more than 300 trees and saplings, primarily olive, vandalized, OCHA reported. Tamara adds that these increasing attacks come on the heels of Israel's stated ambitions for further control, theft, and annexation of the West Bank. The UN Human Rights Office said that, quote, settler violence is escalating far beyond the olive harvest season, making life impossible for Palestinians in many communities across the occupied West Bank and leaving them with no genuine choice but to leave their homes. Even as Israeli politicians and lobbyists try to muzzle exposure of Jewish settler violence against Palestinians by calling it blood libel, settlers brag about the crimes they commit against Palestinians on their private communication channels. Quote, the offenders proudly count the number of Palestinians they've injured, the houses and vehicles they burned, and the damage caused to thousands of trees and other Palestinian property, Yesh Din reported. That's all from Tamara Nassar's recent article, Olive Harvest Season Marked with Assault by Jewish Settlers, on electronicintifada.net. Settlers stormed the village of Tuba in Masafer Yatta in the southern West Bank earlier this week. The local activist organization Youth of Samud uploaded this clip on October 25th. On Wednesday, Israeli settlers reportedly destroyed hundreds of ancient olive trees in the village of Karyut, south of Nablus, according to the Wafa news agency. Farmers said they were shocked to find their olive trees destroyed when they entered their lands in the western area of the village after obtaining a two-day access permit from the Israeli army. The lands are located near the illegal colony of Eli, built on the lands of the villages of Karyut, Al-Sawiya, and Al-Luban Al-Shakia. Local sources noted that this is the second consecutive year that settlers have carried out similar attacks of destruction in the same area, Wafa reported. On Wednesday evening, Israeli settlers attacked the village of Burqa, east of Ramallah, Wafa stated. Settlers attacked the outskirts of the village and attempted to storm it before being confronted by local residents. Israeli forces later stormed the village following the attack, Wafa added. Meanwhile, the Israeli army raided the village of Umm al-Khair in Masafer Yatta on Tuesday morning and handed residents a stack of demolition orders, the latest in a decades-long series of attacks and plans to completely destroy the Masafer Yatta villages and expand the nearby settlement colonies. Village resident Aid Hathaline recorded this clip on Tuesday, showing the demolition orders.
Hello from Umm al-Khair. This is Eid. Umm al-Khair community today shocked by this large number of these demolition orders, which included everything standing here in Umm al-Khair, all structures which rebuilded and built before almost 15 years ago. And also it's include agriculture facilities, also the community center, also living houses, also stores, also kitchens, and we have these type of orders in hand. We have two types of orders. One of them is a final demolition order. This means we have 4 days to appeal in the Israeli court. And this one is a stop working order, which given to a new house.
We've published many features on the Electronic Intifada in the last week, but we wanted to highlight displacement begins with a scissors cut by Isra Al-Sigali in Gaza. Isra writes, quote, "When the Israeli military ordered us to evacuate the north, I cut my hair. When I told my mother, Hadia, that I wanted to cut my hair, she didn't look at me. She didn't even pause from folding the clothes into the suitcase. Go ahead, cut it," she snapped. Her voice was sharp, clipped, like the scissors were about to be. My sister Besma stood behind me, gathering the long river of my hair in her fingers. It reached below my waist, a curtain I had carried for years. She combed slowly, carefully, tugging at knots with a patience that felt like grief. For months since the collapse of the last ceasefire in March, I had promised myself, if there was even the smallest chance the negotiations would succeed, I would keep my hair. Every night I opened Telegram, scrolling for news that might save it. Every morning, nothing. The teeth of the comb whispered through my hair. For a moment, I imagined we were still at home on just another day, my sister braiding my hair. But the smell of gunpowder and smoke and the half-filled bags in the corner of a room of my brother-in-law's uncle's house in Al Rimal, where many relatives had sought shelter, reminded me this was not a comforting routine, but a farewell. She braided tightly, her fingers moving as if she were binding memories into the strands. When she tied the end and laid the braid against my back, her hands lingered. She hesitated. "What a loss," she murmured. The scissors gleamed. "Cut it," I said. "I will not regret it." Snip. 60 centimeters fell. The braid slipped from my head into my sister's palm, and loose clippings curled on the floor like tiny black question marks. Days later, as we were preparing to leave, my other sister, Asma, leaned close. "They say hair holds memory. This braid is full of them. Your new hair will grow, but it won't remember." I lowered the braid into a thin plastic bag. In the mirror, I saw a stranger, the bare nape, the hollow expression. We kept packing in silence, shirts folded, papers tucked away, shoes shuffled into corners of the suitcase. When I finally zipped the bag, the braid lay buried inside, quiet, sealed, a piece of me smuggled into exile. On September 23rd, our company walked more than 25,000 steps. My sister has an app, or more than 5 hours to reach Deir al-Balah. The ceasefire was announced on October 9th. The day after, my family and I went back north to Al Rimal and the apartment we had rented there. Days later, I looked at myself in the mirror. My hair hadn't started to grow yet, and I felt regret. I had said I wouldn't, but I did. That braid had carried years of ordinary days, of laughter and sunlight, of the smell of home. I had cut it to survive, but survival had its own cost. My hair will grow again. Gaza will too. But neither of us will forget the sound of the scissors or the bombs. Those are excerpts from Displacement Begins with a Scissors Cut by Isra Al-Sigali, a writer and translator in Gaza, on electronicintifada.net. And now, as we always do, we wanted to highlight people expressing joy, determination, and resilience across Gaza and around the world. In Gaza, volunteers with the Samir Project, a mutual aid organization, recently kicked off their new initiative called Let's Build It to rebuild areas in Gaza City and the north. They sang songs in honor of the homeland and cleared rubble by hand with shovels and with small tractors. A young boy says, quote, "We are happy today that you are opening up the streets. As you can see, the streets are closed and people are unable to go to their homes. We are happy that you brought a hardworking team. This makes us very happy, and it's a good thing that people can go back to their homes. We promise that we will rebuild. God willing, we'll rebuild it."
Hello. مجد وأرض العزة بلدي الغالية الحلوة غزة
بلدي أيوة يا غزة بلدي
And that's it for the news roundup. As always, go to electronicintifada.net for much more, especially to read our new features by our brave writers in Gaza. You're watching the Electronic Intifada live stream. I'm Nora Barrows Friedman with my colleague Ali Abunima. Hi, Ali.
Hi, Nora. How are you?
I'm hanging in there. No. How are you?
The same. I think I was reading this morning about the feelings. I was reading Al Jazeera's coverage about how people in Gaza are feeling after this latest massacre and the sense of uncertainty. And I was thinking about our discussion with Asim and Nabih last week and the sense of limbo people feel. And although it's obviously different for us not being in Gaza, I think we can relate to that sense of this neither being the full scale genocide we've seen, but it's certainly not a ceasefire.
Right. And I mean, as Euromed said, you know, now they're, transforming it into like this low level, low intensity, you know, slower genocide. It's still a genocide. It has never stopped being a genocide, but they're just trying to normalize this now. Yeah.
Based just on the last couple of weeks, it's gone from, you know, a daily massacre of 50 to 150 people to a weekly massacre of 50 to 150 people, because that's exactly what we're seeing.
I just keep thinking of like of these families with these young children, you know, who have survived displacement after displacement and bombings and airstrikes and you know, disease and malnutrition and lack of medical care and lack of clean water and, you know, taking care and somehow evading, you know, death and their own slaughter after 2 years to then be killed in a so-called ceasefire period. It just, I don't know. It's really hard to understand. And it just, it's, you know, people that we know in Gaza, journalists who are there are, you know, are saying that people are walking around in a state of shock, in a state of, you know, unmitigated trauma and disbelief that you know that this has happened and is continuing to happen. It's unbearable.
Well, we'll certainly talk more about what may come next later in the program, but we should, in order to keep our focus on Gaza and what's happening there, shall I bring on our next guest?
Please do.
All right. Well, you're watching and listening to the Electronic Intifada live stream. I'm Ali Abunama here with my colleague Nora Barrows Friedman. Iman al-Hajj Ali began contributing to the Electronic Intifada during the first weeks of the genocide. I've just turned 22, Iman wrote in November 2023. My birthday should have been a joyful occasion spent with family and friends. Instead, it was agonizing. The sounds of celebration were replaced by those of bombardment. I cannot get over the fact that the Islamic University of Gaza, IUG, has been destroyed by Israel's warplanes. Iman added, a few months ago, I graduated from the IUG with distinction. I had envisioned a splendid future. Everything has changed irrevocably. I had hopes of continuing to study as a postgraduate in the IUG. My hopes are now ruined. Iman grew up in Gaza's Al-Maghazi refugee camp, and her work has appeared in The New Arab, Al Jazeera, Mondo Weiss, The Nation, The Washington Report for Middle East Affairs, and other publications, and she is a proud member of the Gaza Writing Project, We Are Not Numbers. In April, Iman was among a group evacuated from Gaza to take up scholarships in Ireland. I met Iman there for the first time in May, just a few weeks after she arrived in Dublin. She made a powerful speech at a huge rally in Dublin, marking Ireland's National Day of Solidarity with Palestine. This was the first time I ever saw Iman in real life, and I just want to share a clip of that moment now.
I've witnessed this devastating genocide for about 17 months. And now, after I left Gaza, I find it hard to believe that I'm here when my family and my siblings, along with the Palestinian people in Gaza, suffering and living in chaos.
Since then, Iman has been pursuing her master's degree at Trinity College in Dublin, and at the same time continuing to write, speak, and advocate for an end to the genocide and for justice in Palestine. She recently spoke at the European Parliament in Strasbourg about Israel's systematic attacks on journalists in Gaza. Iman has also written a zine, a short book called The Mirror of Memory, recounting some of her experiences during the genocide. It's available from the Zines for Palestine project, and you can find out more about that and how to get a copy at the website olivesandmelons.com. That's olivesandmelons.com. So we're really pleased that Iman could join us today on the Electronic Intifada live stream. Welcome, Iman.
Hi, Ali. Thank you for inviting me. It's my pleasure to be among you today.
It's our honor. So good to see you, Iman.
Thank you, Nora.
It really is. Thank you, Iman. So it's been almost 3 weeks since the start of the so-called ceasefire, which, as we've seen over the last days, can be shattered by Israeli massacres at any time. I just want to start by getting your reaction to the current situation in Gaza and what you're hearing from your friends and your family who are there right now.
Yeah. So I don't know how to begin, because there is nothing called ceasefire. So when the ceasefire was announced just a few weeks ago, and we were told by the world or by the foreign leaders, that the genocide would come to an end, or that people would finally return back to their homes, or to find a moment of peace, either for us as Palestinians living in Gaza, or people or Palestinians living in the exile like us here in foreign countries. So all of us wanted to let ourselves believe it, or we wanted to believe that the ceasefire that the bombing would finally stop, or that the mass killing, or that this is the time for people to start piecing their selves or their lives back together without being fearful or without being afraid of being killed or bombed at any time. But we had a moment of hope, as any other, as Palestinians who have been waiting for this moment for a long time, who have been waiting for a moment of ceasefire, for a moment of peace. But living under the Israeli occupation, you know, it crushes the Israeli occupation, that it tries to crush our hope all the time. So we know that this hope would not last for a long time, or these peaceful moments would not last as long as there is an Israeli occupation that it tries all the time to disturb the situation in the Gaza Strip. So the violence never ends. Like since the beginning of the ceasefire, hundreds of people have been killed, and many people have been many buildings have been leveled to the ground, and many children have been bombed in the streets, civilian people, and the situation is really devastating. Like many souls have been lost since the beginning of the ceasefire. So I don't want to say that there is a ceasefire, because it just it's just written on papers, on documents, but on the ground it's not really implemented, and the panic and fear is still among people everywhere. So for example, when we heard about when the violation of the ceasefire started a few days ago, people started rushing to markets to just try to find food like that could they could manage to buy and put in their homes or in their tents, just because they are afraid of a new starvation, or because they are afraid that the starvation and the bombs or the genocide would start again. And this really breaks my heart, because you know, people's minds automatically start just focusing on food, on how like to survive for the next day. They all of what they think about now is just survival, and that's really heartbreaking for human beings, just to make all of their thoughts about like starvation or trying to survive the next day. So I don't know what to say, but there is no actual ceasefire.
Let me ask you, you've described very vividly the sense of continued fear that people understandably have because of the ongoing massacres. When you talk to your family, I assume they also reflect that fear. But let me ask you, over the last few weeks, have they told you about what the situation is like? For example, when they go to the market, do they see a difference? Is there more food available? Is aid coming in? Because what we hear from the international agencies, and what's very clear, is Israel is still blocking aid. At the same time, we hear that in some areas things improved a little bit, but we don't have a clear overall picture. So what are they telling you about that?
Yeah, actually, every time I contact my family, my mother and my dad, and even my younger siblings, they are telling me that the markets, there are a few kinds of goods, but they are with expensive prices. So my family, along with all of the families in the Gaza Strip, or all of the people there, are forced to buy their goods, are forced to buy those kinds of food, which are, if they are lucky, of course, to find that, because it's really rare to find like all of the kinds of healthy food, like vegetables and fruits, like they were found before the genocide, because even if they are available in markets, they are being sold with like unbelievable prices, and not everyone there can afford that. So people are forced to buy such food with such prices, with such costly prices, because Israel hasn't just violated the ceasefire, but it all by airstrikes or by bombing the places or killing people. But it's also like trying to block the aid trucks all the time. Like since the beginning of the ceasefire, we heard that there should be hundreds of aid trucks that were supposed to enter the Gaza Strip daily, but just a few aid trucks that have been allowed to enter the Gaza Strip. And even like I have been scrolling the news and the news from new media outlets, I saw that UNRWA has about thousands of aid trucks that are awaiting outside the border to enter the Gaza Strip, but they are being prevented from entering the Gaza Strip because of the Israeli occupation. So the starvation is still there, and people are being starved. And this is like a way, or the Israeli occupation that tried to use all the time in order to use the starvation as a weapon against the Palestinians. So people are no longer just dying because of bombs or because of missiles, but they are being starved, and starvation has been weaponized against the Palestinians in Gaza. So the situation is still the same. I don't say that there are things that have changed after the ceasefire or the declaration of the ceasefire, because you know the Rafah border is still closed, which is considered as a gate of Gaza to the whole world. Many people have been waiting just for a permission to travel, either for a treatment for the injured people, or either for students to complete their futures, to complete their studies, or even for families to reunite with their other members who have been like forced to evacuate the Gaza Strip, or other people who want to come back to Gaza and reunite with their other family members. I can say also that education in the Gaza Strip is still damaged. You know, people or students who are supposed to begin their academic year, to go to schools, to go to university, but they cannot go to either universities or to schools because the schools have been turned into, you know, into shelters, the crowded shelters for the displaced people. And many, many schools, many educational organizations have been turned, bombed by the Israeli occupation. So I can say that there is a ceasefire, but it's just a, like one day you hear that many people have been killed, many people have been wounded or targeted, like without doing anything. And the other day you hear that there is ceasefire as if nothing happened, as if no people have been killed the other day, as if no buildings have been damaged. So the Israeli occupation is trying to deal with our lives, and this is really sorrowful and heartbreaking that they deal with our lives as sometimes they, like such a game, they deal with the ceasefire such a switch. They sometimes turn it on, sometimes they turn it off, and it's not a ceasefire at all.
It's like a psychological warfare in a way.
Yeah. And it doesn't bring peace anymore. It's just the draining for the people, the Palestinians, a mental health. Like sometimes they do not know what to do, to live peacefully or just to be under the traumatic, the trauma or the traumatic feelings they have been suffering from for a long time, for more than 2 years because of the genocide.
Iman, in that clip of your speech at the rally in Dublin earlier this year, you talked about living through 17 months of genocide. What are some of the experiences that you had that you think is most important for people around the world to know about, to understand, you know, the depth and the gravity of what it means to try and survive, like you said, you know, under just unbelievable psychological conditions, you know, starvation, incessant bombing, and dehumanization. What are some of the experiences that you want to tell the world about and that you've written about?
Actually, I have lived through many horrifying moments during the genocide, and like there are endless things that I want to talk about, but maybe the ones that will still remain or that will still haunt me, maybe I can tell you that forever, like as long as I live, like the first days of the genocide. Like I still remember that day when it was at night, it was really dark, and the first days of the genocide, and the electricity was out. And at that day, like I still remember that day when I was preparing dinner for my family, and all of my siblings, my mother and dad, were sitting in the living room, and I was the only one just in the kitchen preparing dinner for them, you know, trying just to bring a sense of hope while my family were listening to the news because of the horrifying moments that we were living through. At that time, all of a sudden, I didn't see anything, just the red sky around me and the glasses of windows all around me on the ground. And I felt something heavy, like wet, threw on my back at that time, and all of what I was thinking about my family, I started shouting, my mom, my dad, are you okay? My siblings, are you okay? And at that moment, it was a massacre on our street, in the area in which we were living. More than 50 people of our neighbors were killed. And it was really dark, and I was smelling the smells of dust and the smoke everywhere, to the extent that I got suffocated and I cannot breathe, while the door of the kitchen like fell on my back while I was there. And it was really a terrifying moment. And we were hearing the sounds of our neighbors, like who have been asking for help, help us, we need an ambulance. They were under the rubble, trapped under the rubble, and we could hear their sounds. It was an unforgettable night for me. And this is one of the horrifying moments that I have lived through the beginning days of the genocide. And after that, the things started to get more and more intense. You know, we have started to hear about the orders by the Israeli occupation to divide the Gaza Strip into two areas, to the south and north. At that time, we were shocked. Like, we didn't believe it. Like, how is it possible for one land, for one people, for Palestinians living in one land, to be just divided into two areas? So at that time, we have heard the orders for people who have been living in the north to move into the south to so-called the safe zones of Salah al-Din Street. But of course, we knew that there was no safety at all in any place in the Gaza Strip. And we started to hear that the evacuation orders at that time started to get nearer and nearer from the place in which we live, to the extent that we have heard about an invasion, a military invasion of the place, of the area in which we were. And at that time, we said, no, we will not evacuate. We will not abandon our homes. Like, how can we abandon our home, the place in which we live, the place in which we have spent all of our beautiful moments, our beautiful dreams, the laughter, the sitting in the living room with my family members and other things. It was not really easy for us. And my father was just telling us, no, we will not leave our home. But the things started to be much more complicated and terrifying. And to the extent that the area in which we were, the neighborhood, was turned into just a ghostly place. No one was there. All of the people, all of the neighbors evacuated to Rafah. And one of the nights, while we were in our home, and we didn't see anything, just we was hearing the sounds of tanks, the artilleries were getting nearer and nearer, and the sounds of fire bells at the same time, to the extent that my siblings were crying and we couldn't bear it anymore. So we were forced to evacuate our home. We were forced to do so, and we evacuated to Rafah on a truck. At that time, we survived by a miracle, I could say, and I wrote about that in one of my articles. The Israeli soldiers and with their tanks were surrounding the entrances of our area from every side. And when the truck got through that place, we saw the snipers far away, and just all of us, the children and all of my family members and our relatives who were with us on the truck, all of us lowered our heads, and we were expecting that we would be shooted by the Israeli snipers at any moment. But we survived by a miracle, as I said, and after that we arrived to Rafah, facing our unknown destiny there. We saw a sea of tents there, many people, many displaced people putting their tents that lack the basic things, you know, are tents that are made of nylon and cloth, no privacy, you know, as women as well, like who have been forced to share bathrooms with other people. So the situation there was miserable and unbearable at that time, because, you know, we have lived through starvation as well. We have spent days without even a bag of flour, just eating one meal during the day. And if we were lucky enough to find something to eat, my children, my siblings were starving. And
You wrote, Iman, sorry to interrupt you, one of the articles you wrote, I'm going to put this in the chat, Tamara, tackles the issue of, when I was rereading all your articles yesterday, I noted that you wrote about this issue of women trying to manage their personal hygiene and menstruation during this genocide and displacement. That's something that is a fundamental part of life that many people don't think about outside Gaza. But of course, women in Gaza had to think about it. So that was just, I remembered that when you were speaking about just the being robbed of the basic necessities of life that everyone had to suffer during displacement.
Yeah, it was really miserable. Especially for women, you know, to share the bathroom with public, it was really unbearable. And for me, as a young woman, and for my mom and other Palestinian women who have been living in tents, so it's really unbearable to go through such horrifying moments. Like, the suffering is not only just escaping the bombs, escaping the death, but it's also about going through these suffocating conditions, the lack of hygiene, the lack of the sanitary beds, for example, and other things. So it was really hard for us to go through these moments. And as I was saying as well about the starvation, we have spent many days without even a bag of a flour. And my siblings, you know, were sleeping with empty stomachs during winter, you know. Nothing can warm our bodies. Some of us were sleeping on the harsh ground because we didn't find enough mattresses for all of us and not enough blankets to warm our bodies. So our bodies cannot be warm because we were hungry and because there are not enough blankets to warm us. And this is one of the moments that I cannot forget at all, and it will be etched in my mind forever. And even now, like, it will haunt me. They haunt me every day. And I remember also one of the horrifying moments during the genocide, when during one of the Eids, during the genocide in the Gaza Strip, you know, people in the Gaza Strip, despite the horrifying moments and despite the genocide that's still going on, they try to create a sense of laughter, a sense of joy, especially for the children, especially for the kids. Even that the streets have been turned into rubble, even that there are nothing to enjoy. But during one of the Eids, I still remember, maybe Eid al-Adha, I went with my mother and my younger siblings to one of the markets just to go around and to create a sense of joy for my siblings. At that time, while we were in the car, all of a sudden we saw a quadcopter that started to shoot randomly on different places. It was one of the most horrifying moments that I've ever faced in my life. I saw children being shot by the quadcopters in front of my eyes. Like, it was really horrifying.
I mean, I can't even, I can't even imagine what that's like, you know, let alone every day for 2 years and ongoing.
Yeah.
Iman, what's it been like being outside of Gaza during this time? You know, on the one hand, you're safe, you're able to continue your studies, you have food, you have access to medical care, you have, you know, there are no quadcopters shooting anybody overhead. And on the other hand, you're never not worrying about your loved ones, your family, your community, your neighborhood, your neighbors, your, you know, classmates, your teachers. I mean, what's it been like since you've arrived in Ireland?
Yeah. So for many people now, when they see me that I survived the genocide, and I'm now called a survivor of the genocide, but for many people who have been, I have faced this many times, when they come and chat with me or even talk with me, they are telling me, oh, you are lucky, you survived the genocide. But it's not the case at all. Surviving the genocide, and it's good, yeah, but for a person who have lived the Gaza Strip and left all of the family members there, all of the Palestinians who are still trapped under an unknown destiny by the Israeli occupation during the ongoing genocide. So I left Gaza during the most horrifying moments, just a few months ago during the genocide, and at that time I didn't expect one day that I would travel in such terrifying days or in such terrifying moments. I have always dreamt of traveling, of going outside, of completing my studies, of just in exploring the cities or exploring the countries as any other person who dreams of traveling. So at that time, it was really heartbreaking for me to leave my family members, especially I am the oldest sibling for my family. So I feel that I am attached to them and I hate goodbyes. But at that time, I was forced to do so, to say goodbye for my parents, to my younger siblings. And leaving them was not really an option. And I was forced to do so because at that time I was just thinking about what if I stayed with them and what about my future? What if I left them during these moments, the most moments that they want to be, they want me to be beside them, to stand by them. I feel that I was abandoning them at that time, but I was forced to do so because I didn't have any other options at that time. And I said to them that maybe I promised them that in the future we would write together in this and we will rebuild our lives again. So living here in exile away from my family is not really that, it's not easy at all. I feel that I'm living a second Nakba here. And the fact is that I want to say my family members, along with other families who have been living in Gaza, they are not really originally from Gaza. We are refugees, Palestinian refugees who have been displaced from other cities in the Nakba of 1948. And however, despite the fact that we are not originally from Gaza, but we
and
have
where is your family from, Iman?
We are from Jaffa.
From Jaffa.
So yeah, and along with other refugees there, so we have lived there for many years, and we have always considered our city Gaza as our home, and we have never imagined that we would abandon it or leave it one day. So my first Nakba was while I was in Gaza, when I was forced to displace our home, to go to different stages of displacement. We have been forced to displace more than 10 times during the genocide from one place into another, from 10 to 10. So for me, this was my first Nakba, but my second Nakba is currently now here in the exile, away from my family members, away from my people, away from my home. It's really draining for my mental health to be here. And sometimes I feel guilty when, for example, I walk in the streets and find the markets full of all kinds of food, of vegetables and fruits. I'm thinking about my family along with people who are being starved there. What about them? Sometimes when I'm eating something, like I stop eating because I start to remember my family, my siblings who cannot find this kind of food or these kinds of joyful moments. For example, when I go to the university or while walking in the street and see parents holding their children's hands, bringing them to school, I think of my siblings. I think of the other children in Gaza who have been prevented or deprived of going to schools or have been deprived of their right of education for more than 2 years. So it's really draining for me to try to focus on either my life here or either my family and my people there. I feel that I'm divided. My body is here, but my thoughts, my mind, and my soul is still with them there, like trying to focus on my study, on my work, or to think about what's happening there. And what's more, what's more tragic as well, when I lose the connection with my family, you know, when there's no internet connection, and when I send them a message, or when I try to call them, and they haven't messaged me back or called me back, I start to think like, what happened? Are they alive? Like, for example, the other day, I haven't slept the whole night, you know, because my family didn't have internet connection, because the internet connection there is really bad, and they don't have internet all the time. They just depend on general networks from streets that are, they are not really good with good signals, just weak signals that you could even chat with another person. So the other day, I didn't sleep the whole night. I was just thinking about them, because I haven't heard from any of them. And it's really tiring and draining for my mental health as well, because I'm really also suffering from post-trauma. You know, whenever, for example, I hear the sounds of any plane here in the sky, I just close my ears out of conscious, just feeling that there would be a bomb that would hit this place or that place. Or whenever I hear the sounds of ambulance, I think that there is an injured person that needs who needs help, or there is a martyr who got killed. Like, all of those things that I've lived through in the Gaza Strip are still haunting me till this moment. And it will take a long time, many days and maybe years, just to start to forget about what's going on. And I cannot even, I'm trying to cope with the situation here, trying to live normally, but it's really hard.
Iman, I know I haven't had the experience you've had, but I've spoken, as I know you do, to many of the other young people who've left Gaza, who've been able to get scholarships, and many of them say similar things to you about, of course, it's natural. Any of us would be worried about our family and our parents and our people, and we would never be able to forget about that for even 1 minute. And the feelings of guilt you talked about are very understandable too. I've heard that from many people, and I can understand it, but I want you to know how happy we all are that you're safe, and we want everyone to be safe, but that doesn't mean that you don't deserve to be safe. You don't deserve to be where you are. We're all very happy that you are, and I know that your family is too. We want that for everybody. And I hope that you're able to get in Ireland the ongoing support for this unbelievable trauma that you lived through and are still living through, because it's not over, and we can hear that. And that's support that everyone in Gaza and from Gaza will need. But I hope that you're able to get it too. One thing I can say, Iman, is that you have been incredibly active, in addition to your studies, in addition to staying in touch with your family and your friends in Gaza. You have been speaking out, as we saw from your first days in Ireland. You were speaking out, and you traveled to the UK recently, where you spoke in a number of places. And you also recently went to the European Parliament. Before we let you go, just give us a sense of what's the message that you're giving to people when you go and speak to them, and what's the reaction been?
Yeah, to be honest, my message that I always try to let people around the world to understand is the same. The main thing that I want people to understand around the world, that we are, as Palestinians, we are individuals as any other person around the world. So when people around the world, most of them, when they try to talk about us Palestinians, they just try to show us through a narrow perspective. They focus on us either, they try to show us in the perspective of numbers, in the perspective of politics. So they just show, like, for example, in the new media outlets or in other in political aspects as well. They show the Palestinians in numbers, like how many people have been killed, how many people have been injured, or how many people have been displaced, without showing the other side that we are individuals with stories. We are not just numbers, because numbers, you know, numbers do not show the real stories of the Palestinians, that we are individuals with full of stories of laughter, for example, of tears, of as any other individual around the world. So every time I attend an event or I try to speak in any place, I try to focus on this perspective for people to understand that we are not just numbers in papers or in news, just to talk about how the number of people who have been killed or the number of people who have been injured. You have to go beyond that, just to know the real stories behind that, to know the cruel actions that are committed by the Israeli occupation against the civilians in the Gaza Strip, and to know that we are humans, normal people, as any other person around the world. We want to live peacefully as any other person, as we are the indigenous people of this land. And at the same time, people maybe sometimes show us as victims, as only victims to be pitied, but this is humiliating for us. We don't want the pitiness, or we don't want the sympathy of the people around the world. We want to be treated with dignity, because I feel humiliated when somebody comes to me and like it tries to show their sympathy or their pitiness. This is not a good way to be treated with as Palestinians, as the indigenous people of this land. And another way, people try to show us as unwavering maybe figures, or as people who have to be steadfast all the time, to suffer all the time, as this is our destiny, that we are created or we are born just to suffer. And I'm always wondering, like, what is it our guilt? Why do we have to suffer all the time? Is it just being born Palestinian in Gaza? No, the fact is that we are the indigenous people of this land. We are the owners of this land. And people must understand this. And people must understand that they have to be on the right side. They don't have to be in neutral or to be silent, because in neutrality or being silent in such moments, you need to show the truth to the whole world. It means complicity. It means that you are complicit with the Israeli actions that are committed against the Palestinians in Gaza. Israel has crossed all of the lines by committing the cruel massacres against the Palestinians there. So this is my message all the time. This is what I'm trying, or what I try to let people know, not to be complicit, not to be silent or neutral. Don't be afraid of showing the truth, to tell the people around the world that there is a genocide in Gaza, and the Israel is the occupier, and the Palestinians who live in Gaza are the indigenous people of this land, and they have to exercise their basic rights to live peacefully, to let their children educate, learn, to play in the streets, to travel, to have their right of getting medicine, treatment, just as any other person around the world.
Well, we're all so grateful that you're a member of this community, and that you've been using your platform to speak your truth, and to define what dignity is, and to show that with your words and your actions and your brilliance. And I it's just been such an honor to have you today, Iman.
Thank you.
And Ali, do you want to that link again?
Yeah, Iman, you. I want to show again the book that you recently wrote. We can show that again here. It's available at olivesandmelons.com/zines. It's called The Mirror of Memory. just tell us about this book, Iman.
Yeah, actually, this book is just a smaller version of the book I'm writing now, and it includes some of my experiences, the moments that I've lived during the genocide. It's like a collection of articles, of personal stories, testimonies that I've lived through with my family members, or even about me myself as a writer who have lived during those months in the genocide. It also includes some poems, and I wrote about my late professor there, Rifat El Arir, who was assassinated in the first days of the genocide. So it calls the matter of memory, what remains and what must be remembered. Sorry. So the matter, it means that it's not only about the present, because it's about all the time. It's a chronological thing that shows the Palestinian generations, that shows the Gaza city, and how it's beautiful even during the tough moments, despite the fact that we have been living under the occupation, the Israeli occupation, for many years. People are still trying to survive, to strive, because resilience is what keeps us going on. We are trying to maintain hope despite the horrifying moments, despite the seeds that we have been living under for many years. So it's just a way to show how resilient and how steadfast we are as Palestinians, even despite the horrifying moments we can create and we can persist during those times.
Well, I have just ordered it, and I'm looking forward to receive it. And I hope other people will get to know your work. Iman, you've been contributing to the Electronic Intifada since December 2023, almost throughout the whole genocide. You've written for many other publications, and of course, this zine, this short book you've written, and then you're writing another book. So it's incredible how much you're doing. In addition to your studies, you're an example for all of us, Iman. We're very proud of you, and we're very grateful to you. So thank you for joining us today. And I hope soon, certainly when you finish your book, we'll have you back. But I hope many more times before then as well. And thank you so much, Iman, for all that you're doing.
Thank you so much, Iman. Phenomenal work. Ugh.
Yeah, Iman
is really powerful. She's amazing.
Really brilliant, gifted, determined writer, speaker, advocate, and one of the many very brilliant young people from Gaza, a very highly educated population, a very young population, very ambitious, such a wealth of knowledge. And, I've had the opportunity to meet students from Gaza. And of course, we work with many writers and students in Gaza through the Electronic Intifada. And there is so much brilliance in them. It's breathtaking.
Yeah, truly. Oh, well, that was phenomenal. Thank you for encouraging her to come on the live stream today, Ali. And let's bring on John to talk about resistance. Hey, John.
Hello. Yes, that was a great interview. Iman has been doing great work for a long time now. So I can't imagine how difficult it is for them all to be outside with their families still in Gaza. And they carry it with such dignity. So it was great to hear from her.
Yeah. Well, you're going to talk about some new footage that emerged this week of Yahya Sinwar and some other related issues from Gaza. So take it away, John.
All right. So you are watching and listening to the Electronic Intifada. I am John Elmer. This is the Resistance Report ceasefire edition, such as it is, ceasefire day 21. I am reporting this on the 30th of October. I'm going to touch on a few topics today, including footage that surfaced through the Israeli military of Yahya Sinwar on the front lines in Rafah in the days before he was killed, and a couple brief updates on the West Bank and Lebanon as well. But as usual, let's start in Gaza. Overnight on Tuesday, the Israeli military carried out a wave of strikes, again, ceasefire on Israeli terms, killing more than 100 people, half of them children. And that operation was, according to Israeli media, was through the American mediators, the monitoring mechanism of Central Command. So that is a bad omen about the trajectory of this ceasefire. That is the second major violation of the ceasefire that Israel has executed. But as Nora said in the news report, there's been 125 others besides the massive wave of strikes that we saw overnight on Tuesday. You're looking at a map here, BBC Verify. Not sure if they're watchers of the EI live stream, but a couple days after my report last week on the yellow line and where the placements of that are, which we're looking at a map here that you can see, more than half of Gaza is covered by this yellow line, where Israel is able to operate freely, a free fire zone on the eastern side of the yellow line. And what BBC Verify did, that's their investigations unit, they looked at open source material and satellite footage and the material that the Israeli military showed that I showed on the program last week. If you didn't catch that segment last week, you can find Resistance Reports since the beginning of the war on our YouTube channel in the playlist section. But we covered the placement of these markers along this so-called yellow line that appears to be a central feature of the ceasefire, such as it is. And so I wanted to have people understand the basic outlines of it, and the BBC very handy applied their BBC Verify investigations unit to try to understand where these blocks are. And if we look at the next map, you can see this is in the north. This is just south of Beit Lahia. And you can see where the yellow mark was delineated on the map. Like I pointed out last week, it's very difficult to understand where the lines were. The maps that were presented by the Israelis and Trump were extremely vague. After 2 years of genocide, where Israel has broken down the territory into hundreds of blocks to tell people in a grid where to leave while they're ethnically cleansing, then when the ceasefire comes, they set up this deadly line where they shoot to kill. More than half of the people that have been killed in the ceasefire have been killed around the yellow line. The map was extremely vague. And the keys to this to understand is that the Israeli military is continuing its operations on the eastern side of this yellow line. They're attempting to achieve through ceasefire what they failed to achieve during the war. They're dismantling the tunnel apparatus. They're destroying homes. They're basically carrying out Operation Gideon's Chariots, which was expressly by the IDF said was against infrastructure and not against fighters, because they couldn't defeat the fighters, so they moved on to the infrastructure. And that's what's happening on this other side of the line. Then Israel uses the pretext of any kind of attacks on their forces, which they claim without any evidence have happened, and the resistance has distanced themselves from those attacks. But Israel uses that pretext to carry out its attacks in Gaza, despite what's supposed to be a ceasefire, and it's supposed to be a ceasefire guaranteed by Trump. So the fact that the Israeli military is going through the Civil Military Coordination Center, run by Central Command, is it's a bad omen for the trajectory of this ceasefire. We can look at the next map because we also have this in the south. We have this in the Khan Yunis area. That previous map was showing more than 500 meters distance between where the yellow line was supposed to be, where it was agreed upon in Sharm el-Sheikh, to where it is now. Here we're seeing it in the Khan Yunis area, 300 meters in front of what is supposed to be the line, and Israel continues its military operations in that territory consistently day by day, and their intention is to do that going forward. And they spoke about that directly this week because tunnels are the key strategic infrastructure that Israel's trying to destroy. And numbers this week surfaced, although it's always important to note that the Israelis have no idea how many tunnels there are. But from their estimates, their defense minister said there's at least 60% of the tunnels left. And Gioria Ilant, who's the general, infamously known for the general's plan in northern Gaza, he put the number at more than 80%. But again, they don't have any idea. And that has been part of the way this battle has been fought. It's been clear from day one that they don't know where all the tunnels are. But the defense minister said that the most important strategic objective is destroying tunnels. And so this yellow line and where it is both deadly for Palestinians, but also indicates where Israel is continuing their military operations. And just through the coordination, Reuters was on Air Force One on Wednesday after the attacks overnight in Gaza. And Donald Trump said that he, as he understood it, that the resistance took out an Israeli soldier. The resistance denied that. But he said, so the Israelis should hit back. And they have hit back. When it happens, they should hit back. Nothing is going to jeopardize the ceasefire, Trump said. You have to understand that Hamas is a very small part of peace in the Middle East, and they have to behave. If Hamas are good and they are happy and they are not good, and if they are not good, they are going to be terminated. Their lives will be terminated. We've heard this kind of language from Trump. He flip-flops back and forth on this issue. But he says no one knows what happened to the Israeli soldier, but they say it was sniper fire and it's retribution for that. And I think they have the right to do that. So the principal guarantor of this deal is on side with Israel attacking inside the yellow line and still calling it a ceasefire. He's still calling it a ceasefire. So these are early trends that we're seeing here in this period of ceasefire. If we take a look at the next map also this week, A.L. Weizman from the Forensic Architecture Group published this map just after I had tried with several other maps to show you the ridge lines, the topography of how Israel is ghettoizing the Gaza Strip, and how the yellow line is simply moving, advancing one line, one ridge line there. You can see in the north, the yellow dots all along that ridge line are the ridge line that are to the west of the ridge line that Israel originally ghettoized Palestine with by putting settlements all along that ridge line. The settlements were military placements. Civilians came in later. And this essentially act as a human shield for the Israeli forces in the Gaza envelope. And A.L. Weizman wrote that pretty straightforward. He said in 1948, Palestinians were kettled into an enclave by a line of settlements on the top of the third sandstone ridge, which are the white dots that you see there on the map. That's the Gaza envelope overlooking the armistice line, which is the white line on that map, and along the western slopes of that ridge. The architecture of occupation has simply shifted one ridge westward. We can see that zoomed in on these next two slides to get a better look. Here you can see from Wadi Gaza to the north, and you can see Al-Muntar Hill, Tel Al-Muntar ridge there. That is where the Israeli military is setting up numerous bases. We can see even more zoomed on this next map shows, you can see it up close there. And the topography is key for this because it gives the Israelis overwatch over Gaza. And it also is the farmland in Gaza. So it's cutting off the sustainability, the self-sustainability of Gaza by moving that farmland into Israeli, the Israeli destruction zone where they're attempting to destroy tunnels and carrying on, essentially Israel's carrying on the war as it was just on the other side of that yellow line. If we look at the next map, we can see where the Israelis have set up bases. This is from Al Jazeera, from their investigations unit and their fact-checking agency, Sanad. They're using satellite imagery here to show along that ridge line that you just saw on the previous map where they are setting up more than 40 active military positions along those lines. There's nine of them in nine bases in North Gaza. There's six in Gaza City. There's one in the Middle Camps area, 11 in Khan Yunis, and 13 in Rafah, which you can see Rafah is mostly entirely inside the Israeli-controlled area of the yellow line. So we can see the way that those two things are working together. Now, moving on to the prisoner captives handover. This is the Qassam Brigade's shadow unit carrying out the recovery of remains of Israeli soldiers in Gaza. And everyone in the negotiations in Sharm el-Sheikh, including the Mossad chief, the Egyptian intelligence, Kushner, Jared Kushner, and Trump, all have acknowledged how difficult it is to find bodies and how long this process would take. Trump famously, infamously called the Gaza Strip a demolition site, which he knows from his real estate days. And Jared Kushner on 60 Minutes a couple weeks back, he visited Gaza with Steve Witkoff. And he said, Kushner said that it looked like a nuclear bomb had gone off in Gaza. And so these are the same people that are providing the pretext for Israeli strikes, are saying that it's going to be extremely difficult. There's 10,000 Palestinians stuck under the rubble that the world does not seem to be paying the same attention to as it does to the Israeli captives. The Israeli captives that were almost all killed by Israel themselves and buried in buildings just like the 10,000 Palestinians. And just for understanding about this, because one of the justifications for the strike on Tuesday night was that Israel got only partial remains of one of their soldiers. But just to put that into context, just for comparison, only six of the first 200 bodies, Palestinian bodies handed over by Israel, only five of the six, only six were identified by Israel out of the 200, and five of those six were misidentified. So only one ID of a body, and the bodies were so mangled, as Nora's reported in the news report, and we can't even show you the footage of it because it's so horrific, bound, tortured, executed, burned. The health ministry in Gaza has gatherings where they show the slides of the people killed, hoping that people in Gaza can recognize their bodies. But the people who leave these tents after these showings just say there's nothing, you can't tell anything by what is left of those bodies. So that gives you an idea of how Israel's operating, and they expect Palestinians on the other side to operate in a completely different way. And just another point to underline, civil defense this week had a burial in the Gaza in Gaza City of 42 unidentified martyrs who had been found in the rubble through the ceasefire process. So this is an enormously difficult process, and primarily for Palestinians, who 10,000 of their family members are still stuck under the rubble. People were buried in makeshift graves because there was no time or security to have proper burials. And all of that process is happening in Gaza right now. And Israel's choosing that difficulty to strike Palestinians. We can see that on the next slide here as part of this, the significance of these tunnel operations. These are massive tunnel. This part of the tunnel had been collapsed. We're looking at a massive hole buried. Qassam used the few heavy excavators that are in Gaza to dig out this tunnel, where they believe that their fighters and Israeli captives were, in Hamad town in north of Khan Yunis. And you can see on the next slide as well, the way that the fighters of the shadow unit are going in here. You can see one man with an oxygen tank to go in, or multiple of them with oxygen tanks to go into the extremely dangerous process of going into these tunnels in order to get back, not their family members, but Israeli soldiers under the agreement that that Qassam and all the resistance agreed to and are fulfilling on their side. But according to security sources that told Army Radio this week, that the way that the prime minister's three principal ways of sanctioning Palestinians for the delay in getting back Israeli captives is reducing the scope of humanitarian aid. So essentially using the blockade and tightening the blockade, and the yellow line will also facilitate that. The expanding of the area under Israeli control in Gaza, that means expanding the yellow line and squeezing the territory even more. And the third one is airstrikes on the territory. So these are the ways that Israel is openly saying that they will violate the ceasefire if things are not done to their whims, really, because there's no interaction between the resistance and the Israelis about the process of handing over these bodies. Israel just strikes whenever it feels like. You can see one more slide showing these units. Just one more thing before this slide is the Hamas spokesman Qassam said, "It is a right of our people to bring the necessary equipment, to bring in the necessary equipment to retrieve the bodies of around 10,000 martyrs beneath the rubble. The Israeli claim that Hamas knows the locations of the bodies are false, especially because the landmarks in the Gaza Strip have changed due to the aggression, meaning people in Gaza can't figure out where they are because there's no landmarks. And this is something that Israel acknowledged. They called it devastated terrain warfare. They had a problem with this too from the fighting side, because their own troops were shooting at each other because there was no way to mark and to delineate where one unit and it was operating and where the boundary was for another unit, because everything is flattened. So there's no indications, and that's something that the Qassam brigades pointed out. The Hamas spokesman pointed out that. So that is just following this process. There are now, after today's handover this afternoon, there will be 11 bodies of Israelis still in Gaza after today. On the next slide, you can see this drone story. The Israelis are flying drones over Gaza, and that is a violation of the ceasefire. The resistance clause in the ceasefire was that there would be no overflights for the daylight hours while the captives were being found. And Israel is violating that. And now the U.S. is piling on that here. This is a story from the New York Times last week that says U.S. flies drones over Gaza to monitor. Ceasefire officials say the surveillance missions are part of the U.S.-led international effort to ensure the fragile ceasefire between Israel and Hamas holds. So the U.S. is flying MQ-9 Reaper drones over Gaza, watching Israel violate the ceasefire. And these missions, surveillance missions, are operating in support of the new Civil Military Coordination Center in southern Israel. The CENTCOM has 200 U.S. soldiers monitoring the ceasefire. So they're monitoring Israel's ceasefire violations and saying nothing of it. In fact, they're approving them. So we now have the U.S. And the Israelis working together on violating the ceasefire in Gaza. So just some of those developments from Gaza. Let's turn now to Yahya Sinwar. Footage was released this week by the Israeli state broadcaster, leaked from the IDF, showing Yahya Sinwar. You can see him there. He's cloaked. He's with his commanders, and he's in a house that had previously been occupied by the Israelis. He's on the front lines here in Rafah. This is in October of 2024. This is 3 months after the Israeli military said that they had defeated the Rafah Brigade. And here we have Yahya Sinwar, the leader of Hamas, who, when he was released from prison, said that he would go now and rejoin his place in the Qassam Brigades with the fighters of the Qassam Brigades. And that's what we see. Israel tried to tell people, and the Western media parroted it, that Sinwar was in a tunnel with human shields, captives as human shields. And we know that all of the captives that have been released from Gaza, nobody talked about Sinwar being with them. The only stories of Sinwar are him asking if he can get people anything in perfect Hebrew from the original release in November 2023. That's what people said. There's no evidence of him sitting surrounded by captives. It's absolutely absurd. And this footage puts lie to that. And this footage, it appears to be part of the same set of videos that Al Jazeera got access to from Qassam for the documentary, What Is Hidden Is Greater, that was shown on October, on the October 7th operation. Let's look at the next slide, because you can see the still of Sinwar there. You can see him there. He's got his weapon on his waist. He's got a cloak over his head, which you've seen them, Qassam, use to great effect to hide from drones. Multi-billion-dollar drone industry vexed by Palestinians using camouflage covers. And so this is just what Sinwar always said, that he wanted to return to the front lines with the Qassam Brigades after he was released in the 2011 prisoner exchange. And this footage shows that he did do that. In the next slide, you can see he is here on the front line. This is from the Al Jazeera doc. He's on the front line here with Mahmoud Hamdan, who is the Qassam Brigades battalion chief in Tel el-Sultan. He's going over the battle plans and the maps. And on the next slide, you can see him right on the front lines. He's looking out over a base. That's a Palestinian school that has been turned into an Israeli base. You can see Sinwar here with his tactical vest and observing from a command position this Israeli position. So he's literally on the front lines. And just a reminder, Israel killed Yahya Sinwar by mistake. They killed him because they believed in the ethnically cleansed area of Rafah, they saw human movement. And the way the Israelis responded to human movement was to kill them. They had no idea they were fighters, let alone Yahya Sinwar and Mahmoud Hamdan, two senior commanders who were overseeing the battle in Rafah. So interesting footage there of Yahya Sinwar that we saw this week through the state broadcaster. Again, just more footage showing him on the front lines of the conflict. Just a couple quick updates. One from the West Bank. The Jenin Brigade has been executing multiple operations on a weekly basis around Jenin. Of course, Jenin is now in day 280 of the siege of the camp of Jenin. The Jenin refugee camp has been depopulated, but the resistance hasn't stopped. If we look at this next slide, you can see there was the one before that one, number 21. You can see the battle here with the tunnel. You can see at the top there, this is footage from Yamam. This is a border police special forces unit of the Israelis. And in the top left there, you see a cave, because the fighters in Jenin have moved out of the city because the camp is under siege. And they're fighting out of the caves in the hills around Jenin, just exactly as Izzedine al-Qassam did in 1935 before the Arab Revolt, fighting the colonial occupiers then in those exact same hills north of Jenin, as we're seeing here. This is in Kfar Kud. This was the other day, a many-hour gun battle between Islamic Jihad, Saraya al-Quds, Jenin Brigade, against these Israeli special forces. The battle lasted for several hours. The Israelis called in drone strikes to attack the fighters that were based out of that cave. As I said, there've been multiple Jenin brigades operations over the course of this week. If we look at the next one, we have a poster from Tubas, an operation in Tubas in the north of the West Bank. But Sar'al Quds released some from numbers from their operations in the West Bank. There has been more than 1,081 Palestinians killed in the West Bank since October 7th, more than 8,000 injured, and more than 22,000 arrested. There's still more than 9,000 in prison. Some of those 22,000 have been released. For the resistance part, there has been 80 soldiers and settlers killed, 688 injured in almost 4,000 qualitative resistance operations in the past 2 years, 2,238 shooting operations, 1,300 IED attacks, and 19 downed Israeli drones in the West Bank. And the Israelis are, again, carrying out airstrikes in the West Bank, in the north of the West Bank, in the Jenin area. So moving there from the West Bank to Lebanon briefly, because I think Lebanon is a harbinger of the kind of ceasefire that Israel wants for the Gaza Strip. The Alma Research Center put out this graph the other day, and they're a research center that are focused on the IDF security challenges along the volatile northern border. So they're an arm's length military staffed research institute that tracks these attacks and happenings along the northern border with Lebanon. And since, as of October 26, so almost a year since the ceasefire, there's been more than 613 Israeli strikes in Lebanon. You can see we're looking at a map here that shows the distribution of those strikes, and the half of them are beyond, are north of the Latani River. The south of the Latani River area was the focus of Israel's operations, but they're using the pretext of the ceasefire to vastly expand their operations. 47% of the strikes were south of the Latani River. 37% of the strikes are north of the Latani River. They include 13% in the Bekaa Valley and also strikes in Beirut. And the Alma Center says that the general objective of these strikes is to reduce Hezbollah's operatives' freedom of action and movement and to damage weapons and infrastructure, including infrastructure that is used to rebuild in South Lebanon. The Israelis have killed more than 340 Hezbollah fighters just in the 1 year. It's basically killing one a day. And that is how Israel, that's the honor of an Israeli ceasefire. That is the way they operate in a ceasefire, duplicitous, cowardly attacks, trying to achieve in a ceasefire what they failed to achieve on the battlefield. And we're starting to see that in Gaza as well. So that is the Resistance Report ceasefire edition, such as it is, for day 755 of Israel's genocide.
Thank you so much for that, John. It's really interesting to see those maps, the ones that the BBC finally published, showing these the ridges and just the geographical stranglehold that the Israeli army is still has and is trying to consolidate more of in Gaza. I mean, you know, of course, what is it now? Like almost, it's still about 55-56% of the entire Gaza Strip is under Israeli control still.
Yeah, I mean, depending on where these yellow lines end up being, the original assumption was 53%. There was some at 58%, but if they're expanding it by 500 meters in the tiny Gaza Strip, you're swallowing up many more percentages than that. And also, it's not just a line, like people can hang out right up against the border. They enforce the line with a shoot to kill on the other side of the line. So there's a buffer zone on the other side of the buffer zone. And that is something that people in Gaza have known from the era of Israeli settlements. And of course, in the West Bank, that's how we're seeing the land be stolen in the West Bank, creating buffer zones around settlements that are illegal or outposts that are illegal. And then they enforce a buffer zone around it, which effectively steals, you know, considerably more land than the actual settlement itself does. So,
yeah, that's what they're doing in Masafer Yatta, which I highlighted in the news report, in which Tamara has been reporting as well. They've designated the areas around the villages as like live fire zones or closed military zones. They you know, claim that they're turning it into a military base, but what they're really doing, obviously, is trying to expand the settlements there and just steal Palestinian land in broad daylight, which is the entire
theft came from the Oslo process when they put in a footnote. The Israelis put in a footnote that military bases would not be removed as part of the Oslo process. Yeah. And so Israel used that pretext that they said everything's a military base, everything's a shooting range in order to take vast swaths of the Jordan Valley and also in the Hebron Hills area that you're talking about.
Yeah, yeah. So that's essentially what they're trying to do in Gaza.
It's a difficult situation because for the resistance, the only way the resistance can deal with this is to open back up the war.
Yeah.
And the way the people of Gaza have suffered, it puts the resistance in a really difficult place because people are trying to, especially before the winter, trying to get the little bit of aid that Israel is not delivering that they promised through the agreement. But there's nobody really to stick up for the resistance. The Israelis and the Kushners and the Witkoffs, this is all just by Trump's fiat. This whole deal is Trump's fiat.
Well, not even the other so-called mediators apparently are sticking up for them. But there's a few things I've been monitoring that relate to this that we could take a look at, and some developments on the topic we discussed last week, which was the so-called International Stabilization Force, which this Trump plan calls for. So really, I mean, just to begin with, a couple of stories in the Washington Post that in a way illustrate some of what John is talking about, and again referring back to our discussion last week. That first one, which was published on just earlier this week, I think on Tuesday, Israelis bristle as Trump makes clear who calls the shots in Gaza truce. And this sort of elaborates on some of what we discussed last week, which is how much control, the direct control, the US is exerting over Israel with this unprecedented joint operations center set up at Kiryat Gat with 200 US troops. And we have some quotes in the Washington Post. The Americans aren't just involved, they're leading it. Israel is merely participating, said Brigadier General Ran Kochav, a former air and missile defense commander in the Israeli military. Anywhere in the world where the Americans deploy a joint task force, they push everyone else aside and take command, control, and leadership of the operational activity, Brigadier General Kochav said. He adds, no one in Israel is comfortable with the current situation, referring to discontent in the Israeli military. Then they quote longtime Israeli military correspondent Amos Harel, writing in the Haaretz newspaper that, quote, defense officials have the impression that American scrutiny of Israel has reached a point that usurps Israel's military and diplomatic power. For the first time, America has placed troops in Israel to monitor the ceasefire, said Michael Oren, former Israeli ambassador to the United States. He added, they're monitoring us and they're restricting our movements. So what's interesting there is it just we'll get to this now in the next story, but that paints a picture of really the U.S. calling all the shots, literally, and this being entirely a U.S.-led operation. So everything we see happening on the ground is approved of, if not directly ordered by the U.S. And then the question is, what does this mean for the so-called ceasefire? Well, let's take a look at the next story, which was published on Wednesday, I believe, and this was the day after the Israeli strikes on, you know, overnight Wednesday, which killed more than 100 people, including 46 children. And this story says, you know, just a couple of details. Hamas described the strikes in Gaza as a violation of the ceasefire deal and said there was a clear Israeli intention to undermine the ceasefire agreement and impose new realities by force. Hamas is committed to the ceasefire agreement, and we call on the mediators to take immediate action to compel the occupation to implement the terms of the agreement, said Hamas official Tahir Nunu, according to Palestinian media. In a statement, this is from the Washington Post, the Israeli military said the strikes hit dozens of terror targets and terrorists and named 26 people it said were militants killed in the attacks. In a statement, the Hamas-run government media office said that some of the names were incorrect or made up and that others listed by the military were either still alive or killed earlier in the war. So that just recalls something we've seen. I know John has commented on many times over the past 2 years, Israelis just making up names or just pulling random lists of names as a pretext for these massacres that are really just about imposing collective punishment. Then we come to the key question of, is the U.S. going to do anything to restrain these bombing attacks? And here the Washington Post says, quote, there was no indication, however, that the U.S. sought to rein in the Israeli strikes. And as the bombardment began Tuesday evening, President Trump said that he expected Israel to hit back if a soldier is killed by enemy fire, and repeated his threat that if Hamas is, quote, not good, they're going to be terminated. So as John pointed out, that's rhetoric we've heard before. So this sort of extreme or unprecedented level, so the Israelis say, of U.S. support doesn't in any way interfere with Israel's ability to murder Palestinians at will. And in fact, it never has, because the U.S. has always been, let's say, the engine behind this occupation.
It's interesting to see, it's just interesting to see how honestly, you know, the U.S. is proving that this is how the sausage is made, you know, like this is how U.S. empire works. This is, you know, it was never Israel calling the shots. It's always been an American project or American-led project for the ethnic cleansing and colonization of Palestine. And so it's just kind of notable that we can see that the veneer is completely gone now. And, you know, CENTCOM literally has a base inside, you know, a settlement in Palestine, where it is very proud to publicly be the ones who are literally, as you said, calling the shots here. It's just an interesting note.
Yeah. One other interesting thing from this Washington Post article, as John mentioned, you know, and as you've reported, Nora, the Israeli pretext for this particular massacre was they claimed a soldier was killed. They've actually named him. It's a West Bank settler who was in Rafah. But we don't know the circumstances. As John says, this is a devastated terrain. And we know that the previous massacre, which happened a week ago, last Sunday, you know, a week previous to the most recent Sunday, that they also blamed Hamas for an attack. And then there were reports that you mentioned last week from Ryan Grimm at Dropsite News that the U.S. knew that It wasn't an attack by resistance fighters. It was an Israeli vehicle, a heavy, they said bulldozer or excavator, yeah, that had run over either an improvised explosive device or perhaps some of the unexploded Israeli ordnance that litters Gaza. So for all we know, the same thing could have happened to this Israeli settler soldier. We don't know. We don't have any independent way to verify this. But we do have this quote in the Washington Post from, it says, the Israeli Defense Force identified the soldiers Yonah Ephraim Feldbaum, 37, from the Combat Engineering Corps. At an event in New York on Wednesday, Qatari Prime Minister Mohammed bin Abdulrahman Thani said he believed the attack that killed Feldbaum, quote, was a violation, end quote. We were expecting there would be a response from Israel, he said, speaking at the Council on Foreign Relations. So I just think, you know, it's remarkable if that's the attitude of the so-called mediators, to accept Israel's word at face value and to say, and to shrug and to say, yeah, we knew they'd attack. I mean, if those comments are representative of the attitude, then it shows no effort whatsoever to counterbalance the Israeli and American narrative and approach. Perhaps not that surprising, but notable nonetheless.
Why does Israel get to continue to carry out military operations? The way that's framed makes it sound like there's a bunch of Israelis that are just kind of sitting on their lunch boxes during a ceasefire and someone shot them, and then that needs to be responded to. That's not what happened. You have
what is combat engineering, John? Why don't you remind us what combat engineering is?
They're destroying people's houses. They're carrying on with the exact same operation that Gideon's Chariots was. They're going row by row, street by street, destroying people's houses actively. Sometimes they hit unexploded ordnance. Sometimes they hit, like you said, there's many things that could set an excavator on fire. And it's in a territory that Israel completely controls. So the first people that you would look towards would be the gangs that Israel, that work in coordination with Israel. You wouldn't think of a resistance fighter traversing into that area to carry out an operation to undermine the ceasefire that is getting food to their families for the first time in many months. So there's no resistance objective that's met by attacking these Israeli soldiers. When you read about it in the newspaper in North America or hear from these mediators, you think that these Israeli soldiers are just hanging
planting
out there.
Flowers.
Yeah.
Right? Yeah.
Just, they're all sitting around talking because there's a ceasefire. They're working full time, two divisions of combat engineers, many of them West Bank settlers who are very jazzed to be destroying Palestinian property. And now they have this yellow line that is essentially an invincibility cloak that allows them not only to not be targeted, but if they are targeted, they get to return to full-scale war. It's just, this is a very difficult point in this war because the resistance listened to the population who are their families, who were in desperate situation with winter coming on, and they, massive gamble, trusted that Trump's word would keep this ceasefire in place. And the civil military coordination was something from the negotiations because the resistance wanted some kind of observation, like who's going to be the person to say when the ceasefire is violated by Israel. So they said, well, we'll set up this civil military coordination center, which ostensibly would be the one who would report
the violation by Israel of the ceasefire rather than be the ones who facilitate Israel carrying out these strikes. So what every day when we learn more about what Israel and Trump believe the ceasefire is, it's just, it's elastic. The lines, the ceasefire lines are elastic. The targeting reasons are elastic. It's a bad omen.
Yeah.
It portends a trajectory of an ongoing war where one side attacks the other and the other at risk of their families being genocided can't respond.
Yeah.
And that's very similar to the situation in Lebanon right now, where Israel is attacking on a daily basis, escalating its attacks, killing people, destroying infrastructure in Lebanon, and the resistance can't respond for slightly different reasons in Lebanon that have to do with the politics within Lebanon, but nonetheless, it's a similar dynamic. Some of the issues that you just mentioned, John, and that we discussed last week with what comes next after this so-called first phase, as you emphasized strongly last week, the Hamas only signed up to the first stage of Trump's so-called peace plan, which had to do with the ceasefire, letting in humanitarian aid, and exchanging prisoners, and nothing else. All the stuff about disarmament and all of that, they didn't agree to, even though the United States is behaving as if Hamas signed up to all 20 points, including disarmament and demilitarization, which is just not the case. It's not true for Hamas or the other resistance factions because it's a united front. Now, this morning, we have this article from Barak Ravid, the Israeli journalist in Axios. The headline there is Scoop, U.S. pushing to finalize plan for international Gaza security force. Now, Barak Ravid is basically reliably conveys whatever the officials who fed him the story want us to know or to read. So that's, I think, how you have to understand this. But that headline is somewhat misleading because it gives the impression that this is all just about wrapped up and all the Americans have to do is put a bow on it. But when you read the article itself, it becomes clear that they really are at an impasse in so many ways. And I want to get into some of what the article says, because I think it's very revealing, and get all of your thoughts on it. So it says, U.S. officials have been holding sensitive conversations with a range of countries about establishing an international force to deploy to Gaza and intend to present a plan in the next few weeks. Three sources intimately involved in that process tell Axios. So they intend to present a plan in the next few weeks. That's a very elastic phrase. And they say the U.S. Central Command is taking the lead in drafting a plan for the force. A U.S. official said it involves a new Palestinian police force to be trained and vetted by the U.S., Egypt, and Jordan alongside troops from Arab and Muslim countries. So you see here the commitment to a collaborator force, similar to the colonial police auxiliaries that the British Empire and other empires set up around the world. So these should be Palestinians handpicked and vetted by the U.S., which means by Israel, and working with states or trained by states that are vassals of the United States. So this is about, they're sticking with the plan of creating a collaborator force. And they say countries including Indonesia, Azerbaijan, Egypt, and Turkey have shown willingness to contribute troops, the sources said. Others raised concerns with the U.S. given the chaotic security situation in Gaza. So again, the language here, they have shown willingness. I mean, that's again,
very aspirational.
Very aspirational. And then they point to some of the issues, some of which we discussed last week. And this is very interesting. Well, actually, yeah, there's this quote here. If we don't have reliable security and governance in Gaza that the Israelis agree to, we will get stuck in a situation where Israel is attacking all the time, one source involved in the planning said. So that, again, goes to show the dangers here. And then Barak Ravid writes, but that all depends, in other words, getting this force in, all depends on Hamas agreeing to give up its authority and at least some of its weapons. Some on the right in Israel and the US argue that the group will never do so voluntarily, so Israel will inevitably have to resume the war. The massive and deadly Israeli airstrikes in response to an alleged Hamas attack in Rafah on Tuesday made that appear all the more likely. U.S. officials are desperate to avoid a resumption of the war and see the ISF, the International Stabilization Force, as a key part of the puzzle, but not one that can be rushed. It is better to move slow and get it right because we are not going to have a second chance, a senior U.S. official told Axios. Anyone want to comment on this point?
Hamas has given up government. That they did that over a year ago when they said that the Community Support Council would take over, a government of technocrats would take over. So that has already long ago been a position of Hamas's. But the Stabilization Force is not. So this needs to be negotiated. And presumably they're waiting while the conflict in Gaza, while Qassam and the Ministry of the Interior are fighting these collaborator gangs that Trump said he wanted them to do and gave them some period of time to do. Internal security in Gaza is handled by Hamas. It's handled by the government, and the police force is a civilian police force. So these things already exist. They don't need to be done through this International Stabilization Force, which presumably this stabilization force is only going to operate in the yellow line areas, not in Gaza itself. So you end up having what looks like a secondary force, because the Palestinians across the board have been very clear that they do not want an international force, that a force will be considered an occupying force. And the way that this is structured in this agreement, it absolutely is an occupying force. So I'm not very confident about this next stage of the negotiations.
Well, that's nor are they. So
yeah,
that's clear in the
scrambling
in the next part of this article, where Barak Ravid says that the ISF, the International Stabilization Force, was a key topic of discussion in the meetings Trump's envoys Steve Witkoff and Jared Kushner and Vice President Vance and Secretary of State Rubio had during their recent visits to Israel, the sources said. A senior Israeli official said the U.S. side presented its ideas about the size of the force, while the Israelis stressed that the size matters far less than its legitimacy with the local population and willingness to fight and kill if needed. So you can see what the Israeli goal here is. They want Palestinian traitors and Arab traitors to go in and finish the job of destroying the resistance that the vaunted Israeli army was unable to do. They want Palestinian traitors to go into Gaza to fight and kill other Palestinians if needed. Quote,
which is a non-starter for the
resistance. Well, but this is what Israel wants.
Yeah. Well, they're trying to set up a free Gaza, right? You've heard that terminology on the other side of the yellow line, that there would be this free Gaza where the collaborators and the gangs and the thieves will all hang out, presumably with this security force, and not interact with the Gaza population, which is all on the other side of on the western side of the yellow line in the
urban districts. It's not entirely clear how far they want to go. Clearly they would have to start behind the yellow line, but it's not clear that they want to stop there. But this U.S. official quoted by Barak Ravid says, quote, "The Israelis are nervous and skeptical because they're not in control and they don't have the cards anymore. We told them, let's create the right circumstances and see if Hamas is serious or not." And then Barak Ravid points out the obvious here, what we've been saying. Few countries are prepared to send their troops to fight Hamas or get caught in the crossfire between Hamas and rival groups, not to mention Hamas and Israel. Turkey is prepared to participate, but Israel opposes any Turkish presence in Gaza. However, the U.S. wants Turkey involved along with Qatar and Egypt because it sees them as best able to get Hamas to agree and to behave, according to a U.S. official. That language of behaving we heard from Donald Trump as well. Quote, "The Turks were very helpful in getting the Gaza deal, and Netanyahu's bashing Turkey has been very counterproductive," the U.S. official said. "We are aware of the Israeli concerns and are working to create something that can achieve stability and that both sides can find acceptable," the official said. Now, this mention of both sides is interesting because who is the other side? Mm-hmm. Well, it turns out that the other side here is Hamas. And it says, from Barak Ravid, he says, "A primary goal right now is to get Hamas to agree to the ISF's deployment, according to a source who is deeply involved in the process. Quote, if you are going into an environment where Hamas sees you as an occupying force, it will be hard. But if Hamas consents, it's a different situation," the source said. "In such a scenario, the ISF wouldn't have to fight a war against Hamas, but only enforce the peace and fight elements that try to interfere." So you
such
you
as have, Israel, like,
well, is this, but you have goals that are completely at odds for this yeah. force, because yeah. they understand that they can't send in soldiers against the wishes of Hamas, and on the other hand, Israel only wants a force that is going to go in and fight Hamas.
Right.
So these are fundamentally incompatible goals.
Yeah.
And then finally, here we're getting sort of to the crux of this. U.S. and Israeli officials say that, as expected, Hamas is using the ceasefire to reconstitute and restore its grip on Gaza, as if, of course, as John just pointed out, Israel isn't continuing its operation during the ceasefire. But the officials added that the current situation on the ground, with the border with Egypt blocked and Israel still controlling half of Gaza, limits Hamas's ability to rearm and rebuild. Hamas has a pretty low glass ceiling now, a U.S. official said. Now, the key point here is they say that no matter what happens, so they say Egypt, Qatar, and Turkey told the U.S. that Hamas could agree to the deployment of the ISF, a U.S. official said. Based on discussions with Hamas, the mediators think the group would agree to the ISF monitoring the borders and possibly conducting missions inside Gaza. So they might find some formula to let them in, but not to fight. But the key point that this article comes to is that it says that although this is a very difficult process that may not succeed, in the end, the leverage they have is that they control the borders and the amount of humanitarian aid coming in, which mm-hmm. notably has not increased. And so this underlines the fear I think many of us have, is that having failed in 2 years of genocide and war to destroy the resistance, having failed to get the resistance to just surrender its weapons, they will fail to put together a collaborator force willing and able to disarm the resistance. So the default will be to maintain the starvation siege and basically to go back to full-scale war or even 50% scale war, mm-hmm. I don't know what, some mm-hmm. kind of lower level ongoing bombardment, all under the guise of a ceasefire. So right. that's all to say they haven't made progress despite this headline trying to spin it. They are trying to square an impossible circle. They're not likely to succeed. In the meantime, Israel is going to unpick the ceasefire. They're not facing any pushback from the Americans so far. On the contrary, the Americans seem to be approving it. And things are not changing on the ground for people in Gaza. So it's a somewhat bleak assessment, I have to say. But that is a lesson and a message to us to remain absolutely focused and mobilized yeah. in terms of continuing to draw attention and put pressure on every yeah. complicit element that we can to stop aiding and abetting this genocide, to stop the arms supply to Israel. Sanctions are needed more than ever.
Yeah.
None of this is over by any stretch.
No, go ahead.
These are just very confused plans. If you can even call them plans, it just seems to be a lot of talk, a lot more wish casting. As complicit as Turkey has been with Israeli genocide and Israeli war crimes and the Israeli economy over many years, I don't see Turkey fighting against Hamas on the ground on behalf of Israel.
No one is going to. No one who can
it just
will.
Seems like a non-starter.
Yeah.
Nobody who is capable of doing it will do it.
Mm.
And nobody who would be willing to do it is capable of doing it.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. I mean, look, they successfully made several new collaborator gangs across Gaza, Palestinians, but they're really small and are easily
captured and dealt with. So it continues to be an incredibly bleak situation. As you said, Ali, all of the elements that need to happen in order to stop Israel have to be escalated at this point. Activism, protests, sanctions, boycotts, campaigns to bring the perpetrators of this genocide and this project of Zionism to account, to isolate it and to force it to stop killing Palestinians and taking their land. Like Iman was saying, this is not over. The genocide is ongoing. It's transforming now into a different scale. And it is up to us to fight against the normalization of these lower intensity.
Yeah, they're looking for sustainable genocide,
yes.
not sustainable peace, but politically sustainable genocide.
Yeah.
And that depends on people going back to sleep and turning away from
right.
Gaza and forgetting about it.
Yeah.
If we don't do that, then they will not succeed.
Yeah, absolutely. All right. There are a couple of things we want to highlight. Ali, did you got to see Anne-Marie Jasser's new film last weekend?
I did. Last week, it was screened at the Chicago International Film Festival in cooperation with the Chicago Palestine Film Festival, which is the world's oldest continuously running Palestinian film festival and will be going into its 25th season in April. So if you're in or around Chicago or visiting in April, check out the Chicago Palestine Film Festival. But Anne-Marie Jasser's new film, Palestine 36, is really a sweeping epic. I was really blown away by it. It was very moving, and it's set in, it's based on historic events. It's very historically accurate, although it's, the stories of the individuals that she tells in this film are fictionalized, but they could be any Palestinian village. And indeed, some of the key scenes are very much based in real life events and particular incidents. Why don't we watch? It's opening on theatrical release in the UK and Ireland tomorrow, October 31st. You can come back and freeze that and see it's in towns and cities across the UK and Ireland. Or you can go to the website. Let's see, I have that written down. I'm sorry. I'm losing my
maybe just there. Google Palestine 36.
Yeah, here at film.curzon.com, film.curzon, curzon.com. And if you Google it, you'll find it. But all the show times for the UK and I believe Ireland are there. Look out for that. But why don't we just watch the trailer? Because I think it's so powerful. And yeah, let's just take a look at it.
This is Jerusalem calling.
شو في بالقدس بتضلك رايح جاي؟
بدي شغل يا زلمة.
كل يوم قاعدين نخسر في أرض، في فلاحين طروهم من أرضيهم.
وليش أجوا يعيشوا هون؟
بلادهم بدهاش إياهم.
توماس هوبكنز، برايفت سكرتري تو ذا هاي كوميشنر.
يوسف بساوي.
Is it the right of the English to distribute the land as they like?
Land registration will protect you.
بجهزوا الأرض لكمبانية جديدة
جنب الأراضي بالضبط.
We are asking for your help in protecting our villages.
I ask you all to have faith. We can create a united and peaceful Holy Land.
يا اخوان البلاد عمالها بتضيع من بين ايديك، ما هو يا بنوقف وقفة رجال، يا بنوقف نتفرج.
يا خبيز يا رصاص.
عاشت الثورة!
We are looking for armed bandits.
We've been disturbing the settlers.
This is my little brother. He hasn't done anything.
I advise that the best solution to terrorism is to build a wall.
I cannot, in good conscience, sit here and become complicit in this.
What about your so-called freedom of expression?
That is nothing compared to what's coming.
You're at the crossroads of a major moment in time. Perhaps you should consider which side of history you want to be on.
I won't be prepared to go for more.
Ooh, goosebumps.
Yeah, and for those who are listening and who don't understand Arabic, there were subtitles there, and I don't know if people can go back and access them, and obviously I can't go back and access and reread the subtitles, but it's really an epic film, and as you could see from that clip, it stars Jeremy Irons, Hiyam Abbas, Saleh Bakri, and a really extraordinary cast, and I was just really happy I had a chance to see it, and I want people to see it. And it is coming out in theaters in the US, I believe, early in 2026. So just look out for it. Maybe ask your search and see if it's showing, or ask for your theaters to bring it, because it's really a great, great film.
Yeah. And on a similar note, last week I went to a special screening of Shireen Davis's new film, feature film, All That's Left of You, which tracks a family from Jaffa during the Nakba into kind of a second and third generation of refugee in the camps in Nablus. And it's absolutely just stunning and crushing and beautiful, and so I want people to go see that when they can. It's being distributed by Watermelon Pictures, but I think it has yet to be picked up by a major distributor to get it into most cinemas here in the US, because of course it's Palestine related, but be sure to go and see that if you can. It's opening, I think, in a limited release in early January. So it's called All That's Left of You by Shireen Dabbas, who, of course, did America back in 2010, I believe.
And she that film. That was in theaters, too. I saw that in the movie theater.
Yeah, it's beautiful. Yeah. So, yeah, check that out. I got to meet her, and she's a big fan of EI. So, yeah, it was great and just a beautiful, very moving film. So speaking of beautiful and moving films, we have a short clip of a documentary that our contributor Rueda Amer just produced, and we published published it yesterday, called Families Living on Gaza Beach Have Nowhere to Go. So you can see that on the Electronic Intifada if you go to the website. You can also see it on our YouTube page. Do we want to play a short clip of it, maybe 20
yeah,
30
let's,
seconds.
Let's just give people a taste.
Great.
نزحنا هنا على البحر ولا اخذنا ولا حرامات ولا شيء ما لحقتش اخذ شيء ضليتني اخر وحده في الحاره قلت يمكن ها نضلنا غادت فما صارش نصيب نضلنا خبطونا اول شيء قذيفه على البيت بعدين خبطونا صاروخ زنانة فأخذت أولادي وجوزي وطلعت إجيني هنا على البحر ما لقيتش إلي مأوى أنا قعدت بيجي أسبوعين نايمة بدون خيمة أولاد الحلال اللي حنوا عليا وجابوا لي خيمة قعدت أنا وأولادي طبعا إن شاء الله بإذن الله غريقة فوق فتلاق النار وعندنا تفاؤل إن شاء الله المرة هذه متفائلين أنا بدي أطلع إيش أقول لك بدي أطلع زغرة إنه وقفت الحرب الكل بتأمل إنه يقف الحرب إن شاء الله بتقف
أنا لسه هذه أول مرة أنزح وأجي على الجنوب تمام ومعاناتي في النزوح أن أنا بنادم ما عنديش لخيمة ولا إلي ماوس الناس لا عندي فراش ولا حرمات ولا أي شيء وعندي أطفال بيموتوا من السقع ومن البرد وفي الشلة والبحر لما بيطف زي ما أنتم شايفين نعمل عمالات بالرمل عشان البحر ما يمرقش علينا أسوأ مرحلة أن شفنا الخوف بعينينا وأولادي كانوا هيموتوا قدام عينيا يوم من الأيام وتاني حاجة كمان
Stunning.
So for those who are listening, it's Rueda's report is of Palestinian families displaced, still on the beach, and talking about how they were displaced and what they've gone through, and just the hardships that they're still enduring with no real safe place or no real shelter. So you can watch the whole report. It's actually only a 5-minute video in total on the YouTube channel or on the website there with the story, Families Living on Gaza Beach Have Nowhere to Go. And really great work by Rueda Amer, who continues to do extraordinary work while trying to survive genocide.
Absolutely incredible. And we have a lot that we've published in the last week on electronicintifada.net. Of course, our colleague Omar Karmi's op-ed, Will It Hold?, which asks a lot of the questions that we've been also asking and trying to answer on today's episode. So give that a read, share it with your community. Of course, Tamara Nassar's report there up at the top about the olive harvest and the settler attacks on Palestinians across the West Bank. Just some remarkable feature stories there. So go to electronicintifada.net to check out our features and our blog posts and news reports. And of course, you can get updates. You can get our daily email digest by clicking the Get Updates link. And of course, if you have some funds that you want to give to EI to keep this project going, click the Donate Now link. Ali, were there some people that you wanted to thank this week?
Always. I want to thank each and every person who's watching, listening, reading, who supports our work in any way by being here, by bearing witness, by sharing these stories, by commenting, liking, sharing, all those things that just help us spread the word and get more and more people to know and understand. And that's actually one of the things that really keeps my spirits up. People know that these have been difficult years for all of us. And what keeps us going every day is that we see our work having an impact. And that's thanks to this community and to people who believe in our work and help us to do it and help us to support all this work, including that video we saw, that report from Rueda, all the reporting we see on the website, everything you see on the live stream. Thank you to everyone. I'm just going to mention a few names just to acknowledge a few individuals. Mark, Stephen, Rina Deep, Robin, Devinda, Shazmin, Naomi, Lawrence, Martin, Mary, Don, Francesca, Ahmad, and Peter. Thank you all very much, and thank you to everyone else who has made either a one-time donation, and especially those who sign up for a monthly gift, which really helps to sustain our work and help us to sort of plan and know, you know, that there's support we can count on, and worry less about that and more about putting out the best work we can possibly do for all of you.
Absolutely. Thank you so much for that, Ali. And as always, I want to thank Tamara Nassar, our producer and director of the live stream, and all the other work that she does behind the scenes. Thank you, Tamara. Thanks to Michael F. Brown for fact-checking, Maureen Claire Murphy, our senior editor, everyone at the Electronic Intifada. And on behalf of myself and Ali, John, Asa, and Tamara, and thank you to Ali Gerzon as well for social media. Thank you all, and we will see you next week.